listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 37th edition of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the Soviet Union. We've been working through some of the myths about Stalin's time at the helm at the Soviet Union. And today, myth number four has to do with the non-aggression pact that was signed between the USSR and Hitler's Germany to buy time for the Soviet Union to build its defenses, also known as the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, and we're going to discuss that today. Luciana, a pleasure to speak with you.
Yes, thank you very much. Indeed, we will be talking about the what is known as the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So what was it? First of all, the official title of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is Treaty of Non-Aggression between Germany and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It was signed on 24 August 1939, that's just a week before Hitler invaded Poland, and set off World War II. I have organized this speech, this conversation, in terms of questions and answers, so I'm going to proceed, but please, with questions and then answers, but please jump in when you want to add, as usual.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Second question, was the Soviet Union alone among European powers to sign such a pact? No. In August 1938, the Soviet Union was the last of the European powers to sign a pact of non-aggression with Germany. Now, some of the pacts signed with Hitler's Germany in the 1930s by European powers were the pact between Germany and Poland in 1934, which, if we follow the Molotov-Ribbentrop nomenclature, we would kill it. We would call it the Hitler-Pilsudski pact, but we don't. Then, in 29 September 1938, well, a year before the Soviet Union, we had the Munich Agreement, which involved Germany, Great Britain, France, and Italy. And that's 1938, the Munich, here it's called the Munich Agreement, but it was really a pact between these four countries to cut up Czechoslovakia. I'll refer to that later. Then we have the German... Then we have the Pact of Non-Aggression by Great Britain, which followed by one day the Munich Agreement. So this should be called the Hitler-Chamberlain Pact, but right. It isn't.
Right.
Then we have France signing a Pact of Non-Aggression on 6 December 1938, and we should call it the Hitler-Daladier pact, but we don't. And then we have in June of 1939 Pact of Non-Aggression by Estonia, which should be called Selter-Ribbentrop Pact, but it isn't. And finally we have in June of 1939 we have Latvia's Pact of Non-Aggression with Germany, which should be called the Munters-Ribbentrop Pact, but it isn't.
Right. You know what's interesting also, by the way, aside yeah. from the fact that there were all of these different agreements entered into between all of these various countries in Germany at that time, you also had, going back to the Treaty of Rapallo in 1922, a series yeah. of agreements between Germany and the Soviet Union for non-aggression in 1922, the Berlin Treaty in 1926, and some protocols that were added to that subsequently all the way up through 1935. So, you know, everybody there, I mean, these people are bound by their borders to, you know, be neighbors. Everyone there looking at their common history and the current situation that they found themselves in, entered into treaties to not go to war with each other, and that's the process that they followed until, of course, Hitler went to war with everybody.
Right. There was nothing unusual about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. You're quite right. Correct. Of course, in the 1920s was the Weimar Republic.
That's right. That wasn't Hitler. That was with Weimar. That's right.
Yeah, it was Weimar, which was cut off by the Versailles Treaty from, you know, from dealing with anybody.
Right. World War I. Right.
At any rate. But that's a different story. So now, next question is, did the Soviet Union invade Poland in 1939 together with Hitler? These two questions, the Poland invasion and the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, go together. And as I proceed, you know, the listeners will realize why I ask this question at this point. What does it have to do with the... They might wonder, what does it have to do with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact? Well, it does. So I asked that question, and so did the Soviet Union invade Poland? No. The Red Army moved into territories ruled by Poland that had been ruled by Poland since 1920. The Red Army did not invade Poland together with Hitler, as the impression is given. But in reaction to and after 2 weeks of Hitler's invasion of Poland, this was, you know, the idea was, as will be clearer later, that Hitler and Stalin planned to divide Poland among themselves. But the question, there are so many questions. What was Poland, you know, after Hitler invaded? So here we go. 16 days after Hitler invaded Poland, he made it in September 1st, and 3 weeks after the signing of the so-called Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, the Soviet army occupied, now listen to this, the territory of Polish Belarus, which had belonged to Russia in 1917, and the territory of Western Ukraine, Galicia, which had been a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and was then given to control of Poland after World War One. Right. I hope this is not too intricate. Both these territories had been taken by Poland, that is, so-called Polish Belarus, I mean, it's just Belarus, territories of Belarus, and Western Ukraine. They had been taken by Poland in the Polish-Russian Republic War, that is, after 1920. Now, the majority of people living in these territories were Russian speakers, Russians, particularly in Belarus. I think there was a million difference in Western Ukraine. So this is what, in 1939, now is called Poland. They are basically formerly Russian territories, Tsar Russian territories. So there is a kind of myth in claiming that the Soviet Union invaded Poland. So as we noted, many countries in the 1930s and even before, as you pointed out, countries signed agreements with Hitler. And of course, the most infamous of these was the Munich Agreement, which should be better known as the Munich Betrayal, because in that September of 1938, Hitler convened Benito Mussolini, Britain's Chamberlain, and France's Daladier to decide the fate of Czechoslovakia, very much like the United States today decides the fate of Syria or Nicaragua or, right, you know, any other. Now, at this Munich conference agreement betrayal, there was no representative from Czechoslovakia or the USSR at these negotiations. Poland was a kind of fifth wheel in the background because Poland had a fascist government, a nationalist fascist government. Poland eagerly signed the agreement partitioning Czechoslovakia and took for itself a chunk of it. So, dear old Poland and, you know, Polish spirit, it's high now. Nationalism is high in Poland, so there is a distortion of these facts. So today, the nationalist government of Poland says that the Soviet Union invaded Poland and now destroys the monuments to the Red Army, for example, which liberated Poland from the Nazis. But the fact is that in 1939, the League of Nations did not condemn the Soviet Union for attacking Poland. It recognized the borders of Western Russia as established as a result of and after the Nazi invasion and occupation of Poland. You see, it was a cause and effect situation. And the invasion of Poland, now if you look at the geographic chart, Warsaw is very close to what is now the western border of Russia. Of Russia today. These names are confusing. But at any rate, so Hitler invaded practically the whole of Poland with a little slice that could still be called Polish. And then it's Polish dominated territories in Belarus and Ukraine. Is that clear?
Yeah, and there's more to it, too.
Yeah.
If you look at some
of the course online. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, that too. But if you look at some of the lands that were the subject of this 1939 non-aggression pact, among them are the Baltic states.
Yes.
Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, and those have been, recently, I would say since, the 1980s, the domain of the CIA and the U.S. Efforts to first break up the Warsaw Pact and then the Soviet Union, and now they're more or less the territory for the forward basing of NATO military facilities to Russia's borders, and that includes... Which is the interesting thing. I don't think people here in the United States understood when you had German, NATO tanks with Germans rolling through Poland into the Baltic states last summer, what that meant to the people on the ground there, including, the one-third to a half the population of those countries that are Russians.
That's right. And let's not forget that the that when Germany rolled into those Baltic states, there was a cleansing of Jews too.
Yep.
In Vilnius, etc. So, and then there's the other. That's right. Then there's the other thing that the Hitler's invasion of the 1st of September 1939. What happened is that Poland ceased to exist. There was, after the invasion, the Polish government fled to Bucharest in Romania,
right,
leaving the Polish people to their fate. And this happened in Italy, too.
Yeah.
But German invasion, the king flees, leaves the people.
They always manage to bring their money with them, though. I don't know how they manage that, but they always do, don't they?
Yeah. The fascists, great heroes. Really valiant. So, the Polish government fled to Bucharest in Romania, leaving the Polish people to their fate. There was no way for Germany even to conclude a ceasefire,
that
they cared.
There was no one to sign it. Right.
So Poland was without government. This is why the League of Nations did not condemn the move of the Red Army into Belarus and Western Ukraine, Galicia. They recognized that there were other reasons behind historical from the 18th century on, but they recognized that there needed to be a border between invading Germany and the Soviet Union.
Right, a buffer.
The League of Nations threw out the Soviet Union when it invaded Finland, which was Hitler's closest ally.
Right.
And, the Soviet Union attempted that. And they condemned that, but they did not condemn the move of the Red Army into what is called Poland, incorrectly, since it had held those territories for just, 20 years?
Right. And by the way, for folks that don't understand this, much of Finland was actually Russia for hundreds of years.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you start to ask questions. You have to start to ask questions. And then the answers are so complicated, but not really. So anyway... And Poland, this same government that fled, that government was the first in Europe to sign the Pact of Non-Aggression with Hitler's Germany in 1934, 1 year after Hitler had assumed full power. And this, too, was the government that refused repeated offers of a pact of non-aggression, a sort of an anti-fascist alliance, and protection from repeated offers of protection and non-aggression pact from the Soviet Union.
Right.
This government had refused those. On the contrary, as we noted, Poland was an accomplice and beneficiary of the Munich Agreement, which should be better called collaboration with Hitler.
That's the one they refer to. That's the one that they refer to as Chamberlain as what's the word that they use in
the appeaser.
The appeasement. Yeah, right. That was the appeasement.
Sure, appeasement.
You know,
complete cooperation.
Right. Go ahead. You could have Czechoslovakia. Go ahead. No problem. And so everybody took it. Like Mel Brooks says, a little slice of Turkey, a little daub of Greece. I took a train back in 1990 from what was then Leningrad to Warsaw, which went through or around Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania into Warsaw. And at the border at the time, and this is while, you know, Poland was still in the Warsaw Pact, or actually had just left, I think, because it was June of 1990, so I think Poland had just left the Soviet arrangement. We had to get out of the car of our train, and then they lifted the cars of the train off the carriage and took them to a parallel track that had other carriages that were a different gauge. They were wider. And the purpose of that was so that Germany could never again roll in military equipment into the Soviet Union using the rails, that the gauge of the rail system that came from Germany through Poland ended there, and a different sized track began there going into the Soviet Union. Yeah, it was interesting, like remnant of history.
Yeah. Okay, so next question, why is only the Soviet non-aggression pact called Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact? This is interesting. It's a minor piece of propaganda maneuver, but it's significant. So we know that Ribbentrop was hanged at Nuremberg as a war criminal.
That's right.
The first Nuremberg trial, the trial of the Nazi elite. So coupling Molotov with Ribbentrop is sort of throwing the Soviet foreign minister in the company of a Nazi war criminal. So, for example, the British never referred to the document signed, their non-aggression pact, signed on September 1938 by Adolf Hitler and Great Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. They never call it the Hitler-Chamberlain Pact. The Poles, who signed the treaty in 1934, never referred to it as the Pilsudski-Hitler Pact. So the leaders of Poland, Great Britain, and France all shook hands with Hitler. Joseph Stalin never did. So, you know, that's just a bit of...
Right. Hey, you know, the proof is in the pudding, okay? What happened was, as soon as Hitler advanced up to the, you know, portions of Poland that were part of this, you know, agreement, that they prepared for an invasion of the Soviet Union, which they effected within a year and a half afterwards. So,
And then the other, I don't remember what number of my questions this is, but then, you know, the question would be this, but didn't the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact have a secret agreement with Germany to divide and share, they say, parts of Europe, Latvia, you know, the Baltic states, which I haven't mentioned? Right. Didn't they have a secret agreement? Yes. There were two secret protocols added to the pact. One on the signing of the pact on the night of 23-24 August 1939, 7 days before the Nazi invasion of Poland, and the other secret protocol on 28 September, 28 days after the Nazi invasion of Poland. And these were stipulations that were made in August before the invasion and in September after the invasion of Poland. These were phrased in this way: in the event of the alteration of the present national borders of Poland or the Baltic countries should they occur after August 23. Now, they occurred in September. Hitler took Poland. Now, the pact is very short. Anybody can read it. It has 7 articles and 2 added protocols. And this is what the fuss is all about. That together Hitler and Soviet and Stalin planned to divide up the loot that supposedly happened at the time of the Hitler and Stalin invasion of Poland, which is, I tried to explain, didn't occur at the same time, didn't occur in harmony. One was the consequence of the other.
Right.
And so what the secret protocols determine is where Nazi Germany will stop and the Soviet Union will begin, meaning that this line, both, you know, in Lithuania and in Poland, beyond that would imply an invasion, would
right.
imply war between, it would imply a violation of the Pact of Non-Aggression. And these two protocols have this phrase, in the event of the changed situation, of the changed political situation of Poland, we will determine that this is the line where Germany will stop, here in the Baltic and here in Ukraine.
That's all. That's exactly right. It was clear,
right?
From watching what Hitler was doing at the time, it was clear that he was, you know, stretching out his arms for that Lebensraum, you know, for that living space, for that.
Yeah.
All that there, Germany was going to, you know, draw in a deep breath and snatch as much of the world as Hitler thought that it needed, and certainly, having spoken and written of it for something like, at this point, 15 years, the Soviet Union was included within that. And so all of the real estate between the Soviet Union and Germany was to be looked at as a chessboard to
that's
prepare
right.
for that invasion, which did come pretty
yeah,
shortly
that's
thereafter.
It. That's it. And so I think this is might be my last question. But people might say, wasn't all this dealing and sharing with Hitler proof that the USSR was allied with him?
That's ridiculous.
No, these were measures to protect the Soviet Union from Hitler, not a partnership with Hitler. Now, supposing the Soviet Union had not signed this document, what would have happened? Would Hitler not have attacked Poland? Of course he would have.
Right.
He had already decided, as intelligence shows, to invade Poland in April, as scholars have attested. In addition, and I mean, it's hard to believe that the Soviet Union didn't know that there was an impending invasion of Poland just a week before they signed the pact. It's impossible to believe that they didn't know.
Of course they knew.
So, in addition, if the Soviet Union had not annexed Belarus and Western Ukraine in September 1939, well, Germany would have snapped them up as they did in 1941, and they would have served then in 1939 as the highway to Moscow and Leningrad in 1939. When there is a further complication. The Soviet Union benefited some degree from the pact by gaining extra time. This is really crucial. And buffer territories. The strength of the Red Army in 1939 compared to 1941 is very, very different. In 1941, the Red Army outmanned and outgunned the army of 1939. In other words, the army was not prepared, especially after the attempted coup of the that was exposed in the Moscow trials.
Right.
Now, Germany had occupied all of what was then what was then Polish territory in 1939, the Wehrmacht would have been that much closer to Moscow and Leningrad. And as we know, in 1941, they besieged Leningrad and came within kilometers, was it 30, of Moscow. So gaining that time, sure, was crucial.
Absolutely. It ended up being the thing that decided the outcome of the war.
Absolutely.
No matter how many movies they make in Hollywood showing all of that took place in France with the United States.
We've got to come back to this. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. We're going to have to come back to this next week. And that's going to move us right into myth number five, which has to do with exactly what happened with the actual war itself. The Soviet Union did. This is the myth. The Soviet Union invaded Poland, and not exactly the truth, at least not that time. So, Luciana, thank you so much. It's a pleasure, and I'm really enjoying working through some of this history.
My pleasure with you, Don, always.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Trump's foreign policy could be described as doublespeak. The president doesn't have a defined policy approach. Even goals are difficult to discern. Is this what the art of the deal means? Is Trump's foreign policy making America great again and the world safer? Crosstalking Trump's foreign policy, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Vlahos in Washington. He is a professor of strategy at the Johns Hopkins University. Also in Washington, we have Daniel Faraci. He is the director of Grassroots Political Consulting. And in New York, we cross to George Samueli. He is a fellow at the Global Policy Institute of London and author of the book Bombs for Peace. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Michael, let me go to you first in Washington. You are, after all, a professor of strategy. So, given what we have seen of this administration, does this president have a foreign policy strategy? Go ahead, Mr. Strategist.
Strategy can be the thing itself, or it can be a representation of the formulas and nostrums that float among the privileged ruling elites. And thus, I think you see Trump speaking to the people who most enthusiastically support him, right? His base, so-called. And he is speaking for them as in their voice. And in that sense, much of the rhetoric and delivery of his foreign policy is really shaped to fit his constituency. And part of that is sloughing off this elaborate kabuki theater and highly choreographed ballet that marked elitist foreign policy since 1945. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that's for show, and it's very effective. Now, when it comes to the substance of his foreign policy, it also reflects his constituents. And they like the idea of America first. And, of course, he uses that phrase. And so I'd call his worldview foreign policy a kind of America first version of world leadership, which may sound contradictory, but I don't think it is.
What it
means essentially is detaching. Yeah.
It's detaching.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Finish your thought. Finish your thought. Go ahead.
No, the point is there's a whole level of spin and representation that is not necessarily moored to the actual relationships he's pursuing. So a lot of this is very self-conscious grandstanding for the domestic audience, and he's toning down the leadership end and saying, we will be world leader if it's really helps the U.S. first.
Okay. All right. I guess that's why it's so confusing to understand President Trump, George, because if we just take what Michael said there, I mean, if Trump is, you know, representing his base, then he's betraying everything he said that he would do for the base. Okay. It looks like we're nation building in Syria, tearing up probably one of the most important non-proliferation agreements with Iran. Okay. I'll say it. I didn't like Obama's foreign policy, but I thought the Iran deal was a good deal, and it has shown to be a good deal. Why is he doing that? Is it, again, grandstanding just because Obama did it? Is that a strategy? Go ahead, George.
Well, I think his antagonism towards Obama, trying to differentiate himself from Obama, plays a part in it. But I think that Trump really has no strong views on anything. I mean, he's been on pretty much on every side of every issue throughout his long life. I mean, he's been for abortion, against abortion, for immigration, against immigration, for gun control, against gun control. So what he ran on in 2016 wasn't really his final view on anything. He found that kind of America first and a kind of quasi-isolationist policy worked for him. And it swept him to power. It probably rather surprised him that it was as successful as it was. Once he got into office, he kind of abandoned all of that. And occasionally, he still comes out with his rhetoric about we've wasted $17 trillion in the Middle East, and we could have spent all this money on building roads and bridges. But he's still pursuing the same policy in the Middle East. He still comes out with the stuff that he was doing in 2016 about, well, wouldn't it be great if we got along with Russia?
Yeah.
But he hasn't done anything about it. And, you know, he's had every opportunity since winning the election of seizing this issue and saying, hey, I ran on this platform and this is what's going to happen. You know, that we are going to abandon these ridiculous projects in the Middle East. We are going to try to improve relations with Russia. This is what I won the election on. But he hasn't done it. And he has sort of quite happily just gone along with the Washington swamp that he had so eloquently denounced in 2016.
Yeah, well, Daniel, and the same foreign policy swamp denounced him as candidate, okay? And I think it's pretty clear that, you know, because his appointees are slow in coming because Congress won't vote on them, you still have these old deep state actors still there. And then he, on top of it, he's surrounded him with people like John Bolton and Pompeo. I mean, they have nothing to do with the vision that he presented during the campaign. Now, I will agree with George. He's flip-flopped all through his life. Go ahead, Daniel in Washington.
Few ways to simplify things. His main foreign policy is wherever he has a personal financial interest and branding opportunity, and that's really first and foremost where his heart and soul is. And as George had articulated, this is a lifelong Democrat who turned himself into a Tea Party evangelical conservative for that 36% base to win the election, which was a 30-year record low turnout. And he did a brilliant job at it. The irony, the grand irony, is now that he holds office, he has capitulated everything. There is no White House policy toward the intelligence community, the Pentagon, or state whatsoever. They're autonomous to create their own. And the one thing he stayed true on throughout that whole thing is he's like a Donald W. Obama. He is a hawkish neocon. We were going to get that whether you had Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And if you really look as to what he spoke at on the campaign trail and throughout his life, that's his ideology. So that reflects very well as to why we are where we are in Syria, why a Bolton is hired, in case negotiations don't go well in North Korea, the Iran deal. And I'm not a President Obama apologist either, but that is the one other caveat, Peter, that you pointed out. Yeah. The Iran deal, TPP, Paris Climate Accord, and all negotiation for him is he pledged on the campaign trail that he wasn't Obama. He has disdain for him. On behalf of his personal loyalty with the Clintons, ironically,
right,
over many years. And that guides him going the opposite way of Obama on a lot of those key issues.
You know, Michael, one of the issues that during the campaign and after he became president is that his critics would say that he would be injurious to American allies. Let's think in terms of the Middle East and NATO, right. Okay? But, you know, he's surrounded by people that are supporting policies that, in fact, do that. When we look at the Iran deal, we had Macron in Washington. Merkel is going to show up. I mean, they're advocating to keep the treaty alive, and you know, this is really injurious to the alliance. I mean, I would like to see NATO completely dissolved and have a completely new security arrangement in Europe. I think that's what Donald Trump actually was thinking about during the campaign. So, I mean, the outside world must be looking. I know they are looking at him in bewilderment because. Where is he going to go next? I mean, the attack on Syria recently, that was against international law. The whole world looks at it that way, not the foreign policy blob in Washington. They've probably never heard of international law. Go ahead, Michael.
I think that the U.S. presidency for some time, maybe 30, 40 years, has been captured by sort of set relationships that it has to have. And in many ways, the dependent countries of NATO, even the great powers like France, Germany, and Britain, are essentially pulling the strings. And I think part of Trump's approach was to put them in a situation where they felt less secure about the relationship and thus would be more pliant and more willing to come to Mr. Trump. And that seems to have worked.
Yes, amazingly.
Just as his blustering. Yeah, and it seems to have created the movement in North Korea. Neither Germany, certainly not Britain, and France either, are willing to step up and take over the defense of their realm. And they are not merely dependent on the U.S., but they've grown needy. And so the U.S. doesn't want to be in a position where it has to jump every time NATO gets a twitch. And so what he's doing is redefining the strength of the U.S. in the alliance without overcommitting. And also this kind of representation speaks well with his base, and they're excited because the U.S. is acting like the great power
Let me ask you, but you know, this paradigm here, does it actually make America more solid in the alliance, and does it make the alliance more solid? Because what we have here is a moral hazard, okay? They're not, the Europeans are, you know, they say they're going to spend money and all that, but they're just going to look to Washington for their defense, and you have a president who's actually quite skeptical about all of these things. I mean, that's kind of a very dangerous thing to be in, okay? Because the European NATO allies are like drug addicts. They keep going to Washington to get their next fix. I'll give you the last 20. I'll give you the last 20 seconds in this part. Go ahead, and Michael, go ahead.
The U.S. is in a stronger position, and the word injurious that you brought up is only relevant, I think, if there actually is a threat to NATO. And with Angela on the horn with Mr. Putin all the time, I don't really see the great crisis, especially now that the U.S. has backed off a little from Ukraine. That was the great danger. And
We're going to go to a break. Yeah. We're going to talk a lot about Ukraine in May. Mark my words here. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's foreign policy. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Let me go back to George in New York. An interesting thing happened with this Macron visit, and when we have Theresa May in her domestic crises at home. I'm thinking of the Salisbury alleged chemical weapons attack. Then we had the attack on Syria. And it really is interesting to me how they talk about Syria now. We had Macron, he said, France and the U.S. and allies to, quote, build Syria of tomorrow. Oh, by the way, the United States is making it illegal for other countries and companies to actually help Syria rebuild. It can't be in the part of Syria where the domestic government has control. So, George, it's about exactly 100 years ago we had Sykes-Picot redrawing the Middle East. It seems like imperial habits die really hard. And on top of that, don't you think France, the United States, and its allies have, quote, helped the Syrian people enough? Go ahead, George.
No, yeah, no, that's exactly right. It was hilarious listening to Macron discussing Syria and this role that, you know, the France was going to play in Syria, that doesn't even realize that a few days earlier, the Syrians were celebrating a day of independence. Independence when France evacuated Syria. That's what the Syrians were celebrating, the departure of the French. The idea that they are now going to be welcoming their former colonial masters with open arms is laughable. But I do think that the American, French, British policy in Syria is actually rather dangerous, because while They have no real prospect of winning, because they don't have any likely candidate who can form any sort of a government in Syria. What they can do is to prevent any kind of a settlement in Syria. And I think that's really what they're going to try and do, and which is to prevent any kind of consolidation of Syrian government control. Yeah. Because all the various candidates, I mean, the Americans' proposal for the SDF, which is, you know, largely Kurdish, that's not a no-go, because the Turks don't want them, and, you know, the Syrians, you know, are not going to accept Kurdish rule, and so that's out. So what they're going to try and do is, I think, keep the war going, largely by feeding again the various jihadis. And therefore just, you know, prevent what they see as Russian consolidation in Syria. And I think that's, I think, a danger. And I do think that Ukraine is also a danger. I think that,
yes, I do too.
There are still very powerful forces within Washington, notably the John Boltons and Pompeos, who want to stir up Ukraine and relaunch some kind of a war there.
Well, and they go to Daniel. Western mainstream media doesn't take any interest in these things, but I'm a lot closer to this situation, and things are getting to a boiling point in Ukraine. That's why May is going to be a very hot month. Oh, right before FIFA, the World Cup in Moscow. I'm sure there's no connection there. Okay, Daniel, I mean, you know, looking at Syria, we can talk a little bit maybe about Ukraine some more later, but, you know, you have this flip-flopping going back and forth. And I'm going to agree with Michael. I think that Trump is really expressing the views of his base. So they don't like these foreign entanglements, these interventions, and the terrible waste of money when he wants to get an investment bill passed in the United States, which desperately needs an improvement in infrastructure here. So, I mean, he seems to want it to have both ways, but he can't have both. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, and tweets and rhetoric, aside from policy, is always something to decipher with this president. But I disagree with both of you a little bit on a few points. One, on NATO, there's not this grand re-scheme where France and Germany and everyone are in love with us over NATO and are going to reach their commitments. And in fact, our commitment of 2% is bogus, because we don't even count Iraq or Afghanistan intervention in our NATO estimates. And if we really included things properly, there would be a little more of a balance, but none of that has worked out. And also, backing off of Ukraine, I guess I'm agreeing with you, Peter, and disagreeing with Michael a bit. We did not back off of Ukraine whatsoever. And I have spoken on this program many times on the proxy war with Ukraine and with Syria, and sanctions that are meant as part of a geopolitical bipolar scheme of ours with China and South Korea, to counter Russia on natural resources in the Arctic. And we're trying to bankrupt Russia from being able to develop up there. And in fact, over the last 2 weeks, I mean, I get new news on that all the time, where we're demanding that the waterway be open for international development and traffic, as well as what we're doing in Syria to continue to back jihadis, allow the Turks to do what they're doing in the north, working with Europe and now encouraging the Gulf to come in and develop and basically take over northern Syria. Trump spoke with Macron and basically talked about how it was ours and our territory to prevent Iran from expanding to the Mediterranean.
And that's why I mentioned Sykes-Picot, because that was a partition. And this is what they want to do is another partition here.
Yes.
Michael, you know, one of the things that's happened in the last week or so.
Can I jump one?
You want to finish your point? Go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead, Daniel. Finish your point.
Yeah, I was going to say one final point. Non-intervention is not Trump's base. Trump's base, that Tea Party 36%, are all neocons and hawks as well of the baby boomer generation. So while that rhetoric sometimes works, because that might be what Trump is thinking for the minute or not, they are the John Boltons and Mike Pompeos.
Well,
intervention is what they've always supported.
Daniel, there was a really interesting post-mortem of the 2016 election, and there is evidence, very strong evidence, that a number of counties were flipped because of the anti-war sentiment, that they were Democrats, but actually supported Trump's non-interventionist view. So I would differ with that. Michael, I have a kind of a much bigger question to ask you. Over in the last week or so, we've heard these murmurings that France and the United States and Great Britain want to start going around the Security Council at the United Nations so they can pursue their Syria policy. I find this really very troublesome and dangerous here, because we have to remember what the Security Council was established for in the first place. It was to make sure there would never be another third world war. And now these major powers. Yeah, we're talking in like 19th century terms again. These great powers, they don't want to use international institutions. They abhor international law, or they're just above it. That is very dangerous, because as dysfunctional as the UN is, United Nations Security Council actually works the way it's supposed to, where you don't have a coalition of great powers that brush aside the concerns of others here. I find it truly disturbing, and it's the same powers exactly 100 years later, they carved up the Middle East, and they want to do it again. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, the U.S. is in a difficult position, I think, of trying to restrain developments that could really upend world, stability, peace, whatever you want to call a non-ideal situation that's still better than the worst. And this kind of pushing locally is what Israel and Saudi Arabia are doing vis-a-vis Iran. You see that in Qatar. And then also what you mentioned, the meddling of Britain and France, which have been doing it in Syria for 250 years. And of course, when I talked about the U.S. aggressiveness in Ukraine, I was referring to Secretary of State Clinton. And I think the U.S. needs to pull back enough with the positive effect of seeing to meet the needs of the base, reining in the neocons who are not yet completely in control, and not pursuing policies that will inevitably lead to war, while at the same time looking strong. So this, I think, brings us to the nub of the current vector of Mr. Trump, which is to make a deal with Korea, which is outside of the realms that we've been talking about. Right. And that would give his administration a sufficient authority then to more effectively rein in the Israel, Britain, France, Saudi Arabias that are causing all sorts of pesky problems and might create a basis for coming to some kind of agreement with Mr. Putin in the future. And that the vehicle for that, the framework for that, has not been established. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean it cannot be established. So it's a very fine line, I think, the president is trying to follow.
Well, there's so many opportunities that are being squandered left and right. That's what makes this such a dangerous and tragic time. George, you know, let's look at the reputational issue here. I've said it many times in this program here. Trump wants to tear up the Iran deal while he wants to make a deal with the Koreans. I mean, that's kind of odd, because Because then the next administration comes in and they're going to renege as well. I mean, the United States puts itself in such an awkward, hypocritical position by doing that. Particularly, again, I don't like giving credit to Barack Obama. I really don't. But this was a good deal, okay? And I'd like to correct the president of the United States. All that money that they got, it was their money. It was their assets. It wasn't a gift, everybody. And it was also an arms deal that didn't completely go through in the 1970s, $400 million, and they had to pay interest on it. So, no, there was no gift to Iran. Go ahead, George. Yes. Reputation issue.
Of course. Yes. Of course, absolutely correct. And that's the whole point. I mean, that it's very hard to see how any kind of an agreement is possible in North Korea, because the North Korean leaders would be absolutely insane to give up their nuclear capability. In return for what? In return for an empty American promise that we won't attack you? Why would anyone want to believe that? You know, once Trump goes, the next president, whether it's Pence or Nikki Haley, will immediately go back on that agreement and will indeed attack North Korea. So it would be an absolutely insane policy to go for. Just going back to what you were saying, Pete, about this going to the United Nations General Assembly, I mean, it's so hilarious because the only power that has actually acted in accordance with international law on Syria has been Russia.
Yep.
Russia is in Syria in accordance with international law,
George,
which is at the request legitimate government of Syria.
Let me jump in here. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. I hope I never will ever say President Nikki Haley. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in New York. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.